Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome once again, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for you today, as usual. And Jim, we look at a new poll from CNN and ORC International that shows the president lacking when it comes to major issues that he's really trying to force on the American people right now, namely guns, immigration, and the deficit. On immigration, 44% approve the way he is handling the issue, down from 51% in January. At the same time, his disapproval has jumped from 43% to 50%. So 44 approve, 50 disapprove on immigration. On guns, 45% approve and 52 disapprove. In January, it was a 46 approve, 49 disapprove margin. The deficit, once again, the big gap here. Only 38% approve his handling of the issue, 58% disapprove. And you would think with those issues getting so much of the oxygen right now that his overall approval rating would be going down. But sadly, no. He's up 4 points to 51% because, of course, we think he's doing a good job if he's tanking on these critical issues somehow, Jim.
And it's interesting. This comes as the president is pushing on gun control and immigration. Specifically, those are the two issues that he's talking about the most these days as he flies around the country at about $180,000 per hour on Air Force One. Now, we look at this and it kind of makes us want to bang our head against the wall. People ask, why is this our good martini? We've always known that Obama's personal charisma has been a big part of why he has enjoyed the popularity that he has through most of his candidacy and presidency. People just like him. He's got a, you know, nice-looking wife, nice-looking daughters, seems like a good guy in a lot of ways. So people cut him a lot of slack on issues like the economy that they might not otherwise. And people on the right have been kind of saying, when is it going to, you know, finally assess him? And how long does this feel good, you know, oh, he's a nice guy routine, how long does that get him out of trouble on this? Well, I'm going to put forth a theory. I think it came forth on Ace of Spades or something, who said that for a large chunk of the electorate out there, you know, they see him on The View. They see him going through his NCAA picks on ESPN. They don't watch the news. They don't read the newspapers. They sadly are not reading National Review or listening to Radio America. And so they're getting their impression of the president from a completely different set of criteria than we are. We look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics report and say, oh my goodness, this is terrible. There are, you know, 500,000 people who left the workforce. None of this reaches them, but the NCAA picks do. And so what someone speculated is that at some point Obama is going to make some sort of pop culture faux pas, and that will be what will sink his popularity rating. That in other words, he's being measured by a standard completely different from every other president we're used to before. And as a result of that, we should not be looking for the traditional indicators and traditional factors in assessing his approval rating. It's kind of a maddening set of circumstances, but we can take a certain amount of solace in the fact that, look, when you ask him, do you like how he's handling gun control, you like how he's handling immigration, neither of those are particularly high and he's pretty underwater, just kind of baffling, but also kind of, you know, recognizing that, well, look, America, if you're really not a big fan of this guy's positions, maybe you shouldn't have reelected him.
All right, on to the bad martini now, and this is from Breitbart.com. And if you thought you were encouraged by the fact that people don't like what the president has to say and how he's moving forward on immigration reform, you're really not going to like what we see here from the bipartisan Gang of Eight. Here's what Breitbart reports. Quote, all the members of the bipartisan Gang of Eight pushing immigration reform in the U.S. Senate will band together to block any efforts by other senators to offer amendments to their legislation once it is introduced, according to the Washington Post. This is a story by David Nakamura. Quote, a bipartisan Senate group on immigration legislation is attempting to craft an agreement so secure that the eight members will oppose amendments to its core provisions, an arrangement that could delay the introduction of a bill, people familiar with the negotiation said. Now, Marco Rubio's press office, his spokesman Alex Conan, says that is not the case, that there will be robust debate in committee on the floor, amendments will be involved here. But something tells me, Jim, the more and more we move along this trail here, that Rubio's the odd man out here, and I think he's probably going to get squeezed to the side, and whether he actually stays in the Gang of Eight will probably be the bigger drama as to whether we'll actually have regular order here.
One of those things where I am very wary of what's going to come out of this process. And by the way, it says something that remember regular order, Greg?
Yeah.
Where, you know, remember, you know, I'm just a bill up in Capitol Hill. And, you know, you'd go through a committee and the committee would vote on it and they'd have amendments in committee. Well, now we get like this like secret black box, you know. It's like David Copperfield is behind the the curtain and we hear clanking and we hear indications of what might be in the bill, what might not be in the bill. We get almost, you know, accused of, you know, a big metaphor these days, white puffs of smoke, you know, that will come out when we finally have a final version of the bill.
Right.
And we'll see what comes out. It's possible it won't be terrible, but the longer it gets, the more wary you get. And I think it was Peggy Noonan who made a good point that, like, you could make the argument that nothing good comes out of a 500-page bill.
Huh.
The word comprehensive automatically turns people off these days, and I think for good reason, because the attitude is that usually it's in the 500-page, you know, it's on page 498, subparagraph C of paragraph 2 is where they stick in something where, you know, all of a sudden – the government can take your cans of soup when it feels like it, you know, or some sort of really random bad provision. In other words, these, you know, big sweeping changes ought to be discussed with a lot of daylight, a lot of debate, hearings perhaps, as Senator Rubio keeps trying to emphasize to Patrick Leahy. And we should, you know, go through this and maybe, you know, that if you want to have that, you know, we saw Obamacare as the ultimate, you know, comprehensive effort to deal with the problem. Maybe part of the problem comes when we try to deal with every aspect of a problem simultaneously. What's wrong with doing these things piecemeal? What's wrong with doing, you know, fixing these things one piece at a time? For another story, I'm currently writing about EB-5 visas, which are basically where if you invest $500,000 in a rural area or $1 million in a non-economically depressed area and you create 10 jobs in a two-year period, you can get a U.S. residency visa. Basically, we're importing rich people. It's an attempt to help the economy and basically saying, well, if we're going to take immigrants, let's take the wealthiest ones we can. Well, unfortunately, this has turned into a giant program for fraud, and apparently all kinds of con artists are out there trying to sucker people into giving large amounts of money. I'm sure that somewhere in this 500-page monstrosity, there'll be some sort of reform to this program. Why can't we do these things a little bit at a time? Why do we always need to have this all-or-nothing giant bill that almost seems like it's designed to fail because no one in their right mind wants to pass for something that very often is brought to the floor without sufficient time to affect it and to, you know, to really assess it and to decide whether it's, you know, overall in the best interest of the country. So depressing and frustrating. Hopefully Rubio will hold a good line on the hold to a hard line on this, and we'll see how it all shakes out.
If only there was an example of a really long bill that nobody read before it took effect, and then the effects were noticed later to be really detrimental to the nation. If only we had a recent example of that.
So like big promises, right, Greg? And something where, like, even the, you know, the supporters were saying, we don't know what's in it. And even the supporters were saying, well, the only way to see what's in it is for us to pass and hope for the best, right?
All right, on to martini number three now, and the crazy. And MSNBC, of course, owns stock in the crazy martini, I'm pretty sure. And for those of you who watch it, and I'm sorry if you do, but every once in a while you'll see these lean forward promos where one of their hosts goes off on some supposedly eloquent rant about why some socialistic policy would be great for America. The latest edition of this is Melissa Harris Perry. I believe she hosts a show around noontime. And today she's talking about funding in education and how we need to change the way we look at our kids. Listen to this.
We have never invested as much in public education as we should have because we've always had kind of a private notion of children. Your kid is yours and totally your responsibility. We haven't had a very collective notion of these are our children. So part of it is we have to break through our kind of private idea that kids belong to their parents or kids belong to their families and recognize that kids belong to whole communities. Once it's everybody's responsibility and not just the households, then we start making better investments.
Now, if you're listening to this and saying, she did not just say that. Yes, she did.
So part of it is we have to break through our kind of private idea that kids belong to their parents or kids belong to their families and recognize that kids belong to whole communities.
Jim, I'm fascinated that she actually used the word collective there, hardly masking this concept in any way, shape, or form. It harkens back a little bit to it takes a village, but the idea that we're not responsible for and don't call the shots for our own kids is just ridiculous.
You know, Greg, to quote a video game from a couple of years ago, all your children are belong to us. if that really is the case, if this really is her philosophy of these things, Greg, I don't know about you, I could use a babysitter next week. So she's volunteering. Right? I mean, as part of the community, it's her responsibility to take care of my kids if I have to be out at night and Mrs. Campaign Spot's not available. Right? No. Oh, that's not what she had in mind. Oh. This is creepy and disturbing. What's really kind of fascinating, John Podoritz had asked this question yesterday, and I hadn't seen a good reason. No one, at least in all the publicly available biographical informations, there's no indication one way or another or whether this host has children. So this is entirely theoretical to her, potentially. That this is, you know, and it's one of those things where, you know, perhaps if she has children, she'll feel a little differently about whether her children belong to the community, for the community to take care of, and the community to do. But let me just observe something. As, you know, you and I are parents, and I try not to play the I'm a parent and you're not card too much. Let me just observe. America, world for that matter, even, you know, Alexandria and Virginia, I don't trust you. World, you don't have your stuff together. And so I don't trust you to take care of my kids because they're really, really important to me. And to be perfectly honest, looking at all of the other children in the world, except for Greg's, which are really, you know, your child's really cute. Your kids look like screw-ups to me. They're kind of loused up. They're brats. They're misbehaving. They're the ones who are throwing things in restaurants. Mine are sometimes very well-behaved in public. But the point being, I have no interest in taking care of your children. And it'd be really kind of hypocritical for me to expect you to take care of my kids. And frankly, I don't have much faith in your ability to take care of my children. So in light of all that, this whole collective thing is a really terrible idea. Mark Stein had quoted some sort of African proverb of the goat that belongs to the community starves, meaning that to take care of something, someone needs to belong to someone. You know, collective responsibility is another term for no responsibility. The usual lefties are going to say, no, what we really mean is it's the government's responsibility. Well, no, my children are not the government's responsibility. The government louses stuff up all the time. Why would I take that which is most precious in my life and entrust it to the hands of the same people who run the DMV? This is why I strongly suspect this host is either not a parent or perhaps has not quite thought through the ramifications of saying that really your children are the property of the state. Creepy and unnerving, but it's kind of good to see the mask come down from MSNBC. And just one last kind of final thought here, Greg. So, you know, usually when they do these kinds of, you know, let's make a promo things, they probably talk for a while. They decided this was the best thing she said to put out in a promo, isn't it, Greg?
I would assume so.
That's the best, really? Hi, this is my name. Wasn't better? You know, this is the most appealing thing she said in this conversation. You know, I'm looking at this promo, Greg, and thinking, what was left on the cutting room floor? Re-education camps? MSNBC is no longer for different tastes. It just kind of feels like it's reporting from a different world.
Yeah, I think what's on the cutting room floor is the remnants of the Kool-Aid they've all been drinking over there as well. And clearly the message here is, we know better than you. How to raise your kids, because if you're not dancing to our tune and tunes of all the cultural and political orthodoxy that we think you should be following, then, well, you're doing your kids a disservice. So we got to make sure that we straighten them out before you ruin them too much. And maybe they won't toe the line every time we want them to in school and beyond. So, Jim, on that cheery note, enjoy your kids. I will enjoy mine. And we'll talk to you later.
I will see you Thursday, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join Jim and me on Thursday, but we will be back on Wednesday for another edition of the Three Martini Lunch.